As has already been spoken this morning, I'm just really grateful for this community. Scott, thank you for sharing those words and reminding us of this long journey you're on. We do hold you in prayer. I'm grateful for our musicians, for the songs old and new, and Jared, for those words prior to that last song. Words really do matter. I really appreciate you sharing your uneasiness with those words. Growing up, we used words like lost and found a lot growing up in faith. And it was pretty clear in our mind what those words meant. Lost applied to those people outside the faith, outside of our faith community. And in fact, in the 1970s, doesn't this guy look like he's from the 1970s? In the 1970s, we actually had an evangelistic campaign called I Found It. And the idea was we were found, we were saved, and it's the other people out there that were lost. And you had a button to wear. Yeah, I found it. I found it. Absolutely. Yeah. Well, time has a way of messing with these concepts, and so does Jesus, and so does Luke, actually, because it seems like when Luke talks about people who are lost, they tend to be people inside the faith system. They tend to be the religious people who are lost. And so if you look at the title on the folder today, it says, How to Get Lost. I'm really not speaking about people outside the faith. I'm speaking about us, people of faith. How do we get lost? A few years ago, 2 years ago, actually, you may remember, there used to be projection screens up here and projectors on both sides, and a team of us actually took those down and put up these LED, LCD displays. Larry, you were probably there. You're there every time we do something hard, and I remember Colin was there helping us hoist these things up, and Nate and Derek and someone, I'm sure I'm missing someone, but maybe Nathan Murray was there. But we got these things up, and they looked great, and I mean, almost perfectly straight, not perfectly, but almost. And then my brain, which my daughter tells me is a little neurodiverse, my brain was bothered because even though the screens were gone and the new LED displays were up there, there were still projectors up on those beams up there, right there and right there. So the next day, I brought my orchard ladder over, and I got up on as tall as I've ever been on my orchard ladder with my ratchet, and I took down those projectors. Now, what I'd like you to imagine is that I'm up there, top of my orchard ladder, with my microphone this morning, preaching from up there. Now, if I actually did that, it'd be kind of memorable. You might actually remember that sermon for a month, or 2 months, or 3 months. And if I fell, oh my, that would be epic. You'd be talking about this for years. I'd be famous. I'd be dead, but I'd be famous. Well, it turns out that's how we get lost. So we climb up on ladders and we look down on people. And that's what we see throughout this chapter of Luke 20. We see Jesus talking about we see Luke talking about this narrative, this collection of stories about how to get lost by climbing up high and looking down on people. But before we get to Luke 20, let's look at the end of Luke 19. So squeezed between these two sort of famous stories, the triumphal entry and Jesus going into the temple and turning over the tables of the money changers, there's this verse where Jesus weeps as he came closer to Jerusalem and saw the city ahead. He began to weep. And here we see Jesus in his tenderness, in his love. He loved Jerusalem. He loved Israel. He loved the people. And that's such an important context for what happens next, because as often happens, sadness and anger are closely tied together here for Jesus, because then he goes into the temple and he overthrows the tables of the money changers. And we might want to ask the question, when we think about the anger that Jesus has here, who is he most angry with? I don't think laser pointers work with LED displays. We may want to put those projection screens back up. But is it this guy on this level, the guy that's selling, changing the money? Or is it this guy up on the top here? Who's Jesus most upset with? Who's he weeping over the most? Who's the most lost? N.T. Wright, we all, those of us who speak in the Luke series, it seems like we often refer to N.T. Wright, and it's because he wrote a really good book on Luke about, it's called Luke for Everyone. And here's what N.T. Wright has to say. He says, Jesus is not so much concerned with the traders. They, to be sure, are doubtless making a few extra shekels on the side. But that's trivial compared to what the high priests and their entourage have been doing. These are people who have been exploiting others in the name of religion for their own gain. That's about as lost as we can be. And it reminds me, it harkens me back to the words of Melanie last week when we heard some more maybe contemporary examples of people who may use religion as a way to gain financially, to exploit others. So what I want to do, that's all 19. That's chapter 19 of Luke. That gives us some context. I'd like us to now move into Luke 20. And we're going to see these stories. At first glance, they appear to be kind of random stories that Jesus is encountering people, the religious leaders of his time, as Luke is giving these accounts. But as we've seen repeatedly through Luke, these are not random. Luke knows what he's doing. He's putting these stories together for a reason. And they're about standing up high. They're about looking down at others. They're about using religion as a tool to oppress people. So let's look at some of these stories. One of the ways that people can get lost is using that ladder of status. So here's one account, right at the beginning of chapter 20. One day as Jesus was teaching the people and preaching the good news in the temple, the leading priests, the teachers of religious law, and the elders came up to him, and they demanded, "By what authority are you doing all these things? Who gave you the right?" "Let me ask you a question first," he replied. "Did John's authority to baptize come from heaven, or is it merely human?" They talked it over among themselves. "If we say it was from heaven, he will ask why we didn't believe John. But if we say it was merely human, the people will stone us because they're convinced John was a prophet." So they finally replied that they didn't know. And Jesus responded, "Then I won't tell you by what authority I do these things." So for the religious leaders, there are three groups here. It sounds like there's the priests, the leading priests, there's the teachers of the law, and there's the elders. And they come and they're really trying to figure out status. Where in the ladder do you belong? What authority do you have? Where do you belong on this ladder? And Jesus locates. He sidesteps that question and he locates the basis of authority, and it doesn't brilliantly. I mean, in some ways his answer about John the Baptist kind of confounds the leaders, but think about the meaning of that. If you go back to Luke 3, what happens when Jesus gets baptized? There's a dove that descends from heaven, and there's this voice that cries out, "This is my beloved son, and you bring me great joy." That's locating where authority comes from. The religious leaders have status. They want to keep their status. They want to focus authority based on possession. What Jesus says is authority needs to be based on calling, on devotion, on love. This is the location of authority. Looking down from on high is not helpful. A second story that we see in Luke chapter 20, we might label pretense, the ladder of pretense. Here the religious leaders decide to send spies to trick Jesus. So let's listen to this story. Watching for their opportunity, the leaders sent spies pretending to be honest men. They tried to get Jesus to say something that could be reported to the Roman governor so he would arrest Jesus. Teacher, they said, we know that you speak and teach what is right and are not influenced by what others think. Notice the flattery here. We just notice how good you are, Jesus. You're just wonderful. You teach the way of God truthfully. Now tell us, is it right for us to pay taxes to Caesar or not? And he saw right through their trickery. And he said, show me a Roman coin. Whose picture and title are stamped on it? Caesar's, they replied. Well then, he said, give to Caesar what belongs to Caesar, and give to God what belongs to God. Dallas Willard, the Christian philosopher, was sort of famously said that Jesus was the smartest human that ever lived. Likely completely true. And here we see an example of it. The way he was able to approach with such clarity and wisdom these tricky situations. And again, what he sees here is this is not a real question. This is a question about pretense, about posturing. And he sidesteps that and he says, let's show me a coin. Let's just work that out. But this is not real. This is not a real question. A third way that we see in chapter 20, a third ladder is this ladder of certainty. And so here we come across the Sadducees. The Sadducees are a particular religious group. And the verse right before this, I didn't put it up here, but Luke makes it very clear that the Sadducees are known because they don't believe in the resurrection. They don't believe in the afterlife. Another thing about the Sadducees that Luke doesn't mention in the verse before is they only really hold to the authority of the Torah. The rest of the Old Testament, the Hebrew scriptures, the writings and the prophets aren't that meaningful to the Sadducees. Now, keep that in mind as you see what happens here. So the Sadducees come and they say, teacher, Moses in the Torah, Moses gave us a law that if a man dies, leaving a wife but no children, his brother should marry the widow and have a child who will carry on the brother's name. Well, suppose there were seven brothers. The oldest one married and then died without children. So the second brother married the widow, and he also died. And the third brother married her. And this continued with all seven of them who died without children. Now, at this point, I'm starting to suspect arsenic poisoning or something. Something's going on here, okay? But one thing that's real clear is this is a setup. This is not a real question. This is a setup. And finally, the woman also died. So tell us, whose wife will she be in the resurrection? For all seven were married to her. One of the things, I don't remember too much from 48 years ago, premarital counseling, but one of the things I do remember is our counselor said, when you ask questions, they should be honest questions. And by that, it means you can answer either way, and it's okay. If it's a disguised question, not an honest question, it means you have to answer one way or the other, or it means it's a sort of hidden directive that's embedded in a question. Don't ask questions like that, our counselor said. So we've not been perfect at it, but we've tried to ask honest questions over the year. This is not an honest question. The Sadducees are trying to trick Jesus. They're standing above. They're trying to gain status over him. And Jesus replied. And now, there's a brilliance in Jesus' reply, as we've seen in all these. Look for it, because remember, the Sadducees hold to the Torah, but not the other Hebrew scripture writings. Jesus replied, marriage is for people here on earth, but in the age to come, those worthy of being raised from the dead will neither marry nor be given in marriage, and they will never die. In this respect, they will be like angels. They are children of God and children of the resurrection. But now, as to whether the dead will be raised, even Moses proved this when he wrote about the burning bush. Long after Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob had died, he referred to the Lord as the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. So he is the God of the living, not the dead, for they are all alive to him. It would be easy for Jesus to address the Sadducees' question by looking at Daniel, by looking at Isaiah. But he doesn't. He looks at Exodus 3. He looks to the Torah, the place where the Sadducees actually hold some authority. And he provides this answer. Karl Barth was a 20th century theologian, a Swiss theologian. And he wrote about this thing called the absurd contrast. And that's what we're seeing play out here in Luke 20. And this is the way Barth would say it. There's one person who ever walked the face of the earth who has a right to stand above the rest of us. Just one. And what does he do? He humbles himself. He comes down. He clothes himself in frail humanity. In Philippians 2, it talks about how Jesus humbles himself even to the point of death and death on a cross. And what do we do? This is the absurd contrast. We climb the ladders. We try to grasp and climb and cling and prove our status and demonstrate how smart we are. And Barth looks at all this and he says, it's absurd. It's absurd. And it's an easy way to get lost, to climb these ladders that mean so little. Well, Jesus tells a story in the middle of chapter 20 that is very much like this absurd contrast that Barth's talking about. It's a very thinly veiled parable. Here we go. A man planted a vineyard, leased it to tenant farmers, and moved to another country to live for several years. At the time of the grape harvest, he sent one of his servants to collect his share of the crop, but the farmers attacked the servant, beat him up, and sent him back empty-handed. So the owner sent another servant, but they also insulted him, beat him up, and sent him away empty-handed. A third man was sent, and they wounded him and chased him away. Okay, metaphor of the prophets. What will I do, the owner asked himself. I know. I'll send my cherished son. Surely they will respect him. But when the tenant farmer saw his son, they said to each other, here comes the heir to this estate. Let's kill him and get the estate for ourselves. So they dragged him out of the vineyard and murdered him. What do you suppose the owner of the vineyard will do to them? Jesus asked. I'll tell you. He will come and kill those farmers and lease the vineyard to others. Again, a very thinly veiled illustration of what was going on right in front of Luke's eyes, or Jesus' eyes in this moment as Luke's telling the story. You hear a story like this and you sort of have to ask the question, who are we? I don't mean like you and I killed Jesus, but we share the same sort of DNA with the folks who did. Who are we? That we climb up these ladders, we get so lost that we fail to see Jesus, the humble servant who comes and saves us. Lisa and I, just a couple weeks ago, had the joy of seeing the Roman Colosseum. And it's an amazing architectural feat. But as we left, we both had this sort of heavy heart because we heard these stories. We had heard them before, but we heard them anew. Of how many, just hundreds and hundreds of wild animals were sacrificed there in the name of sport, and the gladiators who were intended to be slaves and prisoners of war and criminals, and they fought, and our guide wanted to be sure we knew that they didn't always end in death. Only about 1 in 5 ended in death. 1 in 5 still. Who are we? We just left feeling like, who are we? And if we think that religion is going to save us from this, let's go back 2 weeks to what Colin shared in Luke 18, where there's these two guys in the temple, one of them very religious, and he's crying out to God saying, thank you, God, that I'm not like that other guy over there, that guy that's so messed up. Thank you. And he's climbing high up on that ladder, and then there's the tax collector who's beating his chest and crying out, God, be merciful to me, a sinner. Religion doesn't always save us. Faith doesn't always save us from the ladders that we want to climb. Jesus made this so vividly clear at the end of chapter 20. He writes this, or Luke writes this, he said, then with the crowds listening, Jesus turns to the disciples. So everyone's listening in. He turns to the disciples and he says, beware of these teachers of religious law, for they like to parade around in flowing robes and love to receive respectful greetings as they walk in the marketplaces. And how they love the seats of honors in the synagogues and at the head table of the banquets. Yet they shamelessly cheat widows. And keep this in your mind for a moment. They cheat widows out of their property and then pretend to be pious by making long prayers in public. Because of this, they will be severely punished. And then, so that's chapter 20. That was kind of the assignment today to chapter 20. But we started with 19 because that context was important. And let's look what happens right at the beginning of chapter 21. Because, you know, it's these chapter breaks we make, they're very arbitrary. Right after that, Jesus goes into the temple and he sees this widow giving two coins, putting them in an offering plate. Notice the contrast between what he's just written about these religious leaders high up on their ladders, cheating the widows, and then Jesus goes into the temple and sees the widow. While Jesus was in the temple, he watched the rich people dropping their gifts in the collection box. Then a poor widow came by and dropped in two small coins. No authority, no status, no platform. She's not an influencer. But she has two coins, and she drops them in the offering plate. I tell you the truth, Jesus said, this poor widow has given more than all of the rest of them, for they have given a tiny part of their surplus, but she, poor as she is, has given everything that she has. How do we get lost? We climb up high. We look down on other people. We cling to status, we clamor. And Jesus, this absurd contrast, Jesus comes down. Jesus sees the widow. Jesus dines with sinners. He washes his disciples' feet. He carries the cross. He weeps over Jerusalem. It's an absurd contrast. And I also want to acknowledge, as we're kind of sort of heading into open worship here, I want to acknowledge that in a sense I know I'm preaching to the choir, because Quakers have always held to the egalitarian perspective, the importance of being on the same level, to being equal. But even for us, even as Quakers, this might be an easier concept than it might be among other denominations, but even for us, I wonder if I can sort of lead into open worship with a couple of prompts. Again, I'm reflecting on Melanie's words last week, on the words about prosperity. And I'm wondering if there might be subtle ways that prosperity starts to feel like a spiritual ladder in some ways in our Christian communities. And then in open worship last week, Paul Bach shared a word about, he used the word wealth. And it felt to me like it was an invitation to open up conversation. And I wonder if maybe we as a community have more conversation to have around this, the ladders that we create around prosperity. And here's the other one, and I have to be really, really careful as I say this, because I think it's so complicated. But cultural anthropologists will say that the 21st century has been marked by moral outrage. Now, one person went so far as to say that we wear moral outrage in our time like as a badge of honor. And so social media has certainly contributed to this. And I want to be so careful here because, again, Quakers have always stood for social justice, and we are outraged at things. And Jesus was outraged in the temple. And so outrage is not necessarily a terrible thing. But we're not Jesus. And I wonder sometimes if our outrage combined with our sort of social media propensity might cause us to elevate our own sense of morality above those with whom we disagree. And I want to be so careful in saying that. But I offer those as just a couple prompts as we head into open worship. Here are a couple queries that I'd like us to think about. Where in my life am I climbing a ladder? And what would it look like, or what would it mean to look with tears?